Coming up on Weekend America.
Michael is retired now. These are supposed to be the golden years.
I'm not a violent man, but I told my wife, I think this is about a week or so ago, I'm thinking of getting a pistol and put it in my bedroom. I've never had one. Never.
The weekend's a different kind of place in a retirement community on the U.S.-Mexico border. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Also this hour, Democrats hope to come together tonight by breaking bread.
Eating together is probably the second most intimate act that can happen between human beings.
Can the Clinton and Obama teams really be friends over dinner? And for a Ukrainian singer, America is a tough crowd.
Our profession is not for this place. And our music is some sort of soul subject. It's not material stuff.
The Ukrainian soul lives on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. This weekend, it seems like everybody's competing. The Clinton and Obama camps are competing for delegates, even as we speak. High school proms, the popular girls are competing for prom queen. And the French Open is this weekend. It's full throttle. Tennis greats are fighting it out on the clay. Well, this hour, we'll go outside of Paris, where an American six-year-old tennis prodigy is already battling his way to the top. Can you name a tennis great?
I think of Venus and Serena Williams.
Arthur Ashe.
Martina Navratilova.
Billie Jean King.
Rod Laver, because he made me a sandwich once at the U.S. Open.
I started playing when I was a kid, and I was into the old school tennis freaks like, you know, the Bjorn Borg and Jimmy Connors.
The only one I can think of would be Andre Agassi.
Pete Sampras, but not Agassi.
Andy Roddick, because he's hot.
All Agassi was about was his hair.
He's the only one I know just because he's in the media so much and did, you know, ads for bunch of products.
You know, Rod Laver also made me a sandwich at the U.S. Open once, but how does no one mention Yannick Noah? You remember him?
And talk about hair.
Those voices came, hair.
Yeah, those voices came from San Francisco, Cincinnati, Atlanta, Nashville, and Cambridge, Massachusetts.
This is the radio show about what's happening in America this weekend. Retirement is supposed to mean leisure time. You quit working, take up a hobby, putter around happily. For a lot of Americans, you move south to the sunshine, someplace like Green Valley, Arizona, for example. Green Valley is right along the U.S.-Mexico border, and over the years it's been swelling with retirees. Recently, life there has taken a turn. Reporter David Maxson tells us that wayward golf balls are no longer the biggest hazard in Green Valley.
My late grandfather had a vision for a retirement community in the Sonoran Desert outside Tucson, Arizona, about 40 miles from the Mexican border. He wanted to build an ideal place for people to live out their golden years peacefully. A warm, dry climate, comfortable ranch-style homes, and lots of leisure activities. That's exactly what Green Valley has become. Today there are over 20,000 retirees here, and the average age is 72.
There were six reasons why we moved here. Climate, 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 and golf, golf, golf.
Michael and Claire, who asked us not to use their last name, moved to Green Valley from Wisconsin to retire 12 years ago. Michael said it was like a Shangri-La back then, but not anymore. Reality came crashing in, literally, this April. An SUV carrying 8 undocumented migrants and being pursued by the Border Patrol smashed into their home. Michael gestures towards the house, now being repaired by a construction crew.
The vehicle came right from this area here, missed the curve. They completely knocked that wall out. The car ended up 10 inches from my wife's head in the bedroom. It sounded like a sonic boom or a real loud explosion. It was just unbelievable. I said, what's going on? And my wife said, there's a car in my bedroom. And I thought maybe she was having a nightmare or something, but I went in and there it was.
The truck broke the gas line and an electrical box when it hit. But by some miracle, there was no explosion. Claire and Michael were unhurt. This accident is just one example of the unintended consequences of the recent push for border security. As border enforcement has increased in more populated areas nearby, drug smugglers and human traffickers move to more remote places like Green Valley. And so the people here have watched their peaceful retirement community become a thoroughfare for border traffic. Different people react differently to that. Michael and Claire, justifiably, are afraid.
We both should have been dead. And it's just very traumatic. I mean, for a long time, any noises at night would stir us up. I'm not a violent man, but I told my wife, I think this was about a week or so ago, I'm thinking of getting a pistol and put it in my bedroom. I've never had one. Never.
But others react to the influx with indignation, even anger. Former Air Force pilot Don Sevier moved to Green Valley 3.5 years ago because of his fondness for the desert.
My intent was simply to retire, play golf, and do some exploring. I'm an amateur historian and amateur archaeologist.
But while Don searched for ghost towns and the remnants of abandoned mines, he kept coming across evidence of illegal activity. Out in the desert around Green Valley, he points out the debris left in some of the high-traffic areas.
What you will see around here, empty bottles, clothing of all types, women's personal hygiene. You'll find deodorant, toothbrushes. Here's a pair of ladies' underwear. All of these bottles, they just drop as they finish. Skin cream, pills of some sort.
Don says it's not just the trash that offends him, but the people who leave it there.
They can be murderers, rapists, pedophiles, petty criminals of all types.
So Don got involved with the Minutemen Civil Defense Corps, the pseudo-militia group that seeks to stop illegal immigrants. The Minutemen go out into the desert, armed at times, and report what they see to authorities. For Don, it's the only sane response.
Should I have to worry about people from some other country possibly causing danger for myself or my wife? I didn't ask for them to be out there every day, so the Border Patrol is flying over the area, and I wake up to hearing the womp, womp, womp of a helicopter instead of the chirp, chirp, chirp of a bird. Believe me, I'd much rather hear the birds. I would like to live in peace and quiet like everybody else, but it doesn't seem to be the way it is right now.
Don's not the only one taking action. Shira Wallen moved to Green Valley from Berkeley, California 8 years ago. When she realized how many migrants were dying nearby, she founded the Green Valley Samaritans.
Our mission is to save as many lives as we can on this desert.
Every week, Shira goes down to an aid station on the Mexican side of the border. Here's where around 800 migrants a day are dropped off after being caught by the Border Patrol. Shira administers first aid to the tired migrants. One of them lived in the United States for 20 years. His whole family is U.S. citizens. Children, grandchildren, even his parents had become citizens.
Do you have any family in Mexico?
No, I don't got no family here.
Do you consider yourself an American?
I think I do. I consider myself one. But they don't, so it don't matter what I think.
Are you going to go back, obviously?
Yeah, I'm going back. Crossing through here or crossing through another border.
Shira helps them all. Even a young man whose shoulders are rubbed raw from hauling marijuana across the border.
I was always taught, if someone needed help, you need to help them. You don't ask questions. If they need help, you help them. I cannot live here knowing that people are dying in my backyard and not try to do something.
Of course, most people think of retirement as a time when you finally don't have to do something. But this is what it's come to. Senior citizens packing heat, or providing aid for desperate migrants, or even prowling the desert on lookout. That's something I'm sure neither they nor my grandfather envisioned. But without a comprehensive border policy from Washington, these retirees find themselves on the front line. From Green Valley, Arizona, I'm David Maxson for Weekend America.
And you can see Green Valley for yourself, the accident scene where the SUV hit the house, and others. Go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
While the U.S.-Mexican border is not the only place where people are trying to decide who gets in and who has to stay out, today the Democratic National Committee is meeting in Washington. They're going to be deciding whether they'll seat the delegates from Michigan and Florida. The party stripped the states of their delegates when the states both broke party rules and moved their primaries up earlier this year. Now, that's bound to be a heated meeting. So later tonight, the Democratic National Committee is sponsoring a bigwig fundraiser in Manhattan. They're stressing the need for party unity. And that's a lot of pressure hinging on one meal. So to help them out, we consulted with someone who knows all about food and its deeper meaning, Lynn Rosetto Casper. She's the host of American Public Media's Splendid Table. Now, Lynn, what's so powerful about breaking bread with somebody?
Sitting across the table from someone is often the only time you ever look another human being in the eyes for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And you have no choice about it. The other thing is that eating together is probably the second most intimate act that can happen between human beings. You're taking the nourishment of the other, in quotation marks, into your body. I mean, if you think about this, that is a phenomenal occurrence.
Right.
You
and are that's the intimacy that you were just talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I looked it up. The word companion is actually sort of with bread. It's like you're sharing bread with someone.
Accompaniment is with bread. It is what goes with bread. Because bread for the Western world was always the focus of the meal. In China, for instance, the meal is one of the ways that you establish relationships. And where you sit, for instance, in China, the guest of honor will not be seated next to the host. That guest of honor will be seated facing the host. And then the food. The guest of honor is indicated by which direction the fish points. Exactly. It's that kind of thing.
What difference does the table itself, like the setting of a meal, make?
Oh, huge, huge. If you put people at a rectangular table, think about it, especially a wide rectangular table, you can only talk to the person generally on your left and your right. If it's a narrow rectangular table, you can talk across the table. If it's a round table, but it's no bigger than about 52 or 55 inches, you can have a general conversation. That means that the Obama crew and the Clinton crew seated opposite each other can converse.
Mm-hmm.
The ideal table would be a narrow oval because in a narrow oval, everybody can see everybody. There's a sight line everywhere.
Mm.
And if you really want to build communication, that's what you do.
Okay. So what would you put on the Unity dinner menu?
Well, I think a Unity menu, you would want to know the preferences of everybody at the table. You'd certainly want to know if there's allergies, if there's medical problems, and you'd cook to that. The other thing is that you want to do something that is not so bland. You want some food that they're going to have to work at. So you want to have something like chicken, but you want the bone in. Now, a lot of people avoid that. They say, oh, it's embarrassing. People have to cut it.
Right.
No. Because
you
want
it. Are you people picking it up? And
I don't care. That's what I'd love to see them do. I would love to see. I mean, my thought in a situation like this, and it would really be tricky, is I'd do ribs.
Whoa.
Or I'd do something where they can pick something up with their fingers and have the little bowl with the water or whatever. Obviously, you don't want to make people terribly uncomfortable. But you start eating with your fingers and a lot of walls go down.
All right. Well, I hope they're listening and they can still change the menu before tonight.
We'll send recipes.
All right. Lynn, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Lynn Rosetto Casper, host of American Public Media's Splendid Table. Now you can find a link to the show's latest cookbook, How to Eat Supper. It's all on our website at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Coming up, confessions of a press secretary, recognition of a marriage, and withdrawal of a Dunkin' Donuts ad. Good news, bad news, or no news? Next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Like Scott McClellan, I used to be a loyal spokesperson for the news media. I unquestioningly spouted their line about objectivity, but now I realize I was misled, so in my new bestseller, I reveal that some news is, in fact, good news. Some of it is bad news, and some of it is, in reality, no news at all. I just don't always know which is which. That's why I convene a weekly panel to help me. Here to judge the news this week are essayist David Rakoff, author of Don't Get Too Comfortable. Hi, David.
Hiya.
Ask a Mexican columnist, Gustavo Arellano. Welcome back, Gustavo.
Hola, Bill.
And joining us for the first time, Firuze Dumas, author of Laughing Without an Accent. Welcome, Firuze.
Hello.
Our first topic. In his new book, formerly loyal White House press secretary Scott McClellan charges that the Bush administration waged a political propaganda campaign that led the nation into an unnecessary war, that Bush was intent on confronting Saddam Hussein from the beginning, and that the White House's permanent campaign mode crippled its ability to cope with Hurricane Katrina and other crises. Does this memoir sound to you like good news, bad news, or no news?
This is no news. No news at all. A former Bush official turning on the administration and telling the whole world what the rest of the world already knew. It really is no news. We all knew what this was going to happen. It's going to happen again, and it's got to be happening for the next decade, as, you know, all the way until W himself repudiates his own administration and his tell-all memoir in about 10 years.
It's a two-pronged good news thing. The first prong, I think, is that when history is ultimately written, at least there will be some accounts that are truth. You know, so they're not just simply going back to old kinescopes of the Fox News channel.
Daguerreotypes.
Exactly. And tin types and wall paintings made with berries. But the other reason that I think this is possibly good news is that finally, not just the administration who is tarring him with the disgruntled employee brush, but generally the news media is finally rewarding this culture of spinelessness with what it deserves, which is with, you know, opprobrium, which is like too little too late, dude. It's also finally exposing the media for having fallen down on the job and really having taken our eye off the ball when we should have been preventing a war.
You know, I think it's no news, but one thing that surprises me is that the administration is criticizing Scott and saying, well, why didn't he say anything when he was employed by us? Well, is there like a suggestion box in Dick Cheney's office?
Mm.
How open would they have been to his suggestions?
Right. How confident are you that McClellan really feels this way? McClellan admits his book concept was started out much more tame and the truth dawned on him over time. His critics say, no, you juiced up the book so it would sell.
Actually, what the critics are really saying is that you ginned up your book at the behest of New York book editors, which you know what that is code for.
Yes.
What do we think it's code for? Let's think.
The sway of these liberal book editors.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say, is it A, rhododendrons, B, Jews? Look, so what? Does he not genuinely believe what he's saying? Either way, he was either a liar then or he's a liar now. I mean, what's really the difference?
Our next topic. Last week, the California Supreme Court okayed same-sex marriages. This week, we learned that New York will recognize same-sex marriages from other states. Are these developments good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, as somebody who has been married for almost 20 years, I don't understand why gay marriage is even an issue. I mean, except for the fact that it's this huge diversionary tactic. I mean, here we are fighting a war that's going nowhere. We have children living in poverty right here in the United States. We have our schools that are going downhill, people without health insurance. And all of a sudden, the big issue is gay marriage. You know, I mean, I think if gay and lesbians want to have in-laws, let's let them. That is probably the one thing that will prevent gay marriage, is that realization.
Mm-hmm. Is the movie Monster-in-Law is the one thing that's going to do it?
I just think it's a huge diversionary tactic. And I mean, for a lot of Americans, they think the two biggest evils facing them right now are gay marriage and Iran.
Mm. Don't forget Mexicans.
Gustavo, I have to tell you that I think Iranians are much less popular than Mexicans.
How about if like a gay Iranian married a gay Mexican?
You're listening to Aggrieved Talk.
It's also good news because it's going to guarantee there's going to be record turnouts, at least in California, because right now the people who are opposed to gay marriage, the people who are saying that gay marriage is actually going to ruin quote-unquote regular marriage, they're trying to get a ballot that would change the Constitution of California to define marriage as between a man and a woman. I think in California, though, the people who do support gay marriage, they're not going to stand lightly to do that. I think those people are already going to come out to vote.
It's good news, of course. But here's the thing. I would really like to hear not about the legal issues, not about activist judges, not about states' rights and all that. I would like to hear a cogent, actual cogent explanation of the rationale that it threatens heterosexual unions. It's like doubting the existence of your legs if you pass an amputee in the street. I don't see how that happens.
That might be the greatest explanation ever.
Some Democrats say the timing is bad news because this is going to fire up conservatives, put anti-gay marriage issues on local ballots, and increase Republican turnout in the presidential election.
I just got back from a trip to the Midwest, so I'm not feeling as optimistic. But I think it's going to take people away from the main issues and the whole...
But, you know, Clinton and Obama are against gay marriage. Mm. The Defense of Marriage Act was a Clinton administration initiative. I mean, the governor of California is a Republican. So I don't actually know that it is paintable as quite as partisan an issue as it once was.
True.
Like I said, it just pains me that it's an issue. I think there are other things that we should be focusing on.
Oh, don't be ridiculous. This is the most important issue facing us.
Our next topic. Dunkin' Donuts has pulled a TV ad featuring celebrity chef Rachel Ray after critics said she appeared to be wearing a keffiyeh, a traditional Arab headdress that these critics say has come to symbolize Muslim extremism and terrorism. Is Dunkin' Donuts' withdrawal of the ad good news, bad news, or no news?
I think the slogan, drink this frosty beverage, you infidels, was perhaps
ill-chosen.
Walking the line.
That's what a lot of people are saying now.
That said, visual signifiers and being informed about them, it does look like a keffiyeh. But a keffiyeh is everyday wear in the Middle East.
A problem is when there's a keffiyeh and the guy's holding an AK-47.
Well, that's exactly it. She's not holding a Kalashnikov. She's holding a frappe or whatever it's called or something. So it
no, it's just regular coffee.
Thank you. Thank you, Gustavo.
I think Rachel Ray and Dunkin' Donuts should have been a little bit more perceptive, and they should have known that this was going to start a furor.
Dunkin' Donuts says it's not a keffiyeh. It's a black and white silk scarf with a paisley design.
Well, sometimes a scarf is just a scarf.
Yeah, Rachel Ray might have just thought it was a really pretty thing that would go perfectly well with bad, horrible coffee.
I think, if anything, it just shows the fear around anything around the Middle East right now.
Mm-hmm.
Dunkin' Donuts should have kept the ad and said, you know what, this is what a keffiyeh is, and then just taught something to the American public, as opposed to just giving into this fear.
Mm-hmm. And with that, that's the news this week. Panel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Firuze Dumas, her latest book is Laughing Without an Accent. Gustavo Arellano writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. David Rakoff is responsible for the book Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Female magicians pull visibility out of a hat. Coming up on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper, here with Bill Radke. Now, back in 1981, you may not have heard of Little Eldrick when he first appeared in Golf Digest, but you've sure heard of him now. Tiger Woods, one of the most successful golfers of all times. Well, today we're tipping you on a tennis prodigy, 6-year-old Jan Silva of California. He's there in the stands at the French Open this weekend, but who knows, in a decade, maybe he'll be the next McEnroe. Renee Gattel has his story.
Jan Silva's 3'11" and can barely see over the tennis net. But even from the baseline of this full-size tennis court, he sends back each serve from his coach. His forehand is surprisingly powerful. I'm watching him from the sidelines.
What are you practicing right now?
My forehand.
Your forehand?
Yeah. I don't know how to explain, but I know what it is. It's a stroke.
You'd never know it from the sounds of the court here, but we're just outside of Paris, in Tiffauvert-Grignon. It's a postcard-perfect village with centuries-old stone buildings tucked amid rolling hills. Silva's the youngest player enrolled at the Mouratoglou Academy, an elite tennis school with 17 courts.
Firm wrist.
That's Jan Silva's dad, Scott Silva. He's sitting on the sidelines watching Jan's afternoon practice, which isn't going very well today. Jan's form is all off. In between serves, Jan comes over for a pep talk from his dad.
Best you can.
It's hard.
I'm sure it is, but you can do it. Don't think about it, just do it, okay?
I'm trying to think
like James Blake. James Blake on an approach shot. You do.
Not think about it.
Just rip it, okay? Don't think about it and rip it, okay? That's the key. Don't think about it, rip it.
Jan's story is legendary. By the time he was one, he was hitting foam tennis balls. A videotape of him playing tennis when he was 3 started circulating, and Jan soon caught the eye of Patrick Mouratoglou, the owner of the academy. He invited the Silvas to come visit the school and then made them an irresistible offer. Free training for Jan and room and board for the family. If Jan turns pro, he'll owe Mouratoglou a cut of whatever he makes. Mouratoglou says he's never seen a player so talented at Jan's age.
He's self-confident, and the racket is a part of his body. He doesn't have a racket at the end. In his end, he has just another part of his body.
Silva's parents have been accused of pushing him too hard and putting too much pressure on him. But what his father, Scott, says people don't understand is that Jan loves tennis.
It's easy to just sit back someplace and say those parents are living their lives to their kids. But when they come here and they meet us, when people actually meet us, they leave saying that, you know, this kid is really happy. The direction this is heading is like there's no limits to what could happen with this whole situation. You know,
but you have to admit this isn't really the most normal of childhoods.
What is a normal childhood? It's different for everyone. Childhood obesity is normal now in America. Now, is that okay? Jan, he's doing more athletics than 90% of the kids in America. He is learning 2 different languages. No, it's not normal. It's not normal by any stretch of the imagination, but that's what makes it beautiful.
Du jardin. C'est ça, le jardin.
C'est tout souris.
Jan does seem to live a charmed life. He gets to travel around Europe, he goes to French grade school in the morning, and has private language lessons after lunch. Jan speaks French now better than his parents do. All in all, he seems like a happy boy, all smiles on the court. But he is pretty shy. I asked him to tell me what he likes about tennis.
I don't know.
Do you like playing tennis as much as you do?
Yep.
What do you want to be when you grow up?
Maybe a scientist.
I tried to talk to Jan more, to get a feel for what he's like off the court, but he wouldn't open up. I know he's only 6, but I think the microphone was making him a little nervous.
Oh, man. Why are you still recording it?
Do you get tired of being interviewed? You want it to be done?
Yeah.
All right. So I turned off the recorder. It was the end of the afternoon. Jan had finished his tennis lessons. He headed off to the gym for his evening workout. At the Mouratoglou Tennis Academy in Tiffauvert-Grignon, France, I'm Renee Gattel for Weekend America.
Now, if you want to see this 6-year-old in action, go to our website. There's a video of one of his practice sessions. That's at weekendamerica.org. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. We are about what's happening in America this weekend, and we're doing a series called Weekend Shift. So today we meet a worker who spends her Saturday nights being sawed in half, what you and I call a magician's assistant. Magicians actually call a box jumper. And as Weekend America reporter Nate DeMeo tells us, the world of the box jumper is changing.
There's an old Victorian mansion in the Hollywood Hills that serves as the capital of the international magical community. Seriously.
Tell us, are these cards all different?
It's called the Magic Castle. It's a private club for magicians and illusionists. Pieces of paper are still torn up and put back together. Doves still appear from sleeves. Cards, any cards, are picked and produced in any number of ways. And women like Sophie Evans flounce about in revealing costumes and climb in and out of boxes.
Sophie Evans, ladies and gentlemen.
My first experience watching a magic show was at a school assembly show. The most magical person on the stage was the assistant.
Young Sophie fell in love with magic. A decade later, she was working in a magic shop. She was 18, she was attractive, and it turns out she was the perfect size to fit inside a box.
Met a lot of magicians, and because I'm quite small, they're, oh, you'll fit in this trick, or you can do this, or you can do that.
And soon, Evans was appearing and disappearing on stages around the world, being cut in half and put back together, the whole thing, living her girlhood dream. But not everyone shares the admiration and awe that she felt as a little girl. Blair Baron Larson married into magic. Her husband's family founded the Magic Castle nearly 50 years ago.
I would be dragged to these magic shows, and I would become so enraged when I watched the assistants come on in these little skimpy outfits and be cut in half and stabbed. And I thought, this is the most sexist, disgusting thing I've ever seen.
She wanted to know what drove these women to spend their professional lives on stage, letting men poke them with swords or make them disappear. And Larson found that the more she talked to them, the more she realized that the assistants, not the magicians, are the ones running things.
I have asked some magicians how they do certain things, because I'm in the circle, and they say, I don't know how she does it.
They're unsung heroes, and people don't understand exactly how difficult their job is.
Kevin James is one of those magicians who sized up Sophie Evans in a magic shop. He says while the magician is waving his magic wand, it's often the assistant who's working the trick. She's crouching in a tiny space, working a mechanism with her toes. She's sneaking a device on or off stage. And she's doing it all gracefully and invisibly.
It's being able to do it so well with your eyes closed and so you can forget about the technique so that you appear to have no technique.
But the job is changing. Blair Baron Larson says there's a generational shift underway in magic.
This generation is saying, we want to be in the spotlight. We're the magicians. Sure, we'll assist sometimes, but this is not going to be our life.
And for girls who love magic, there are more and more female role models, women with their own solo acts.
She was upstairs last week in the palace with Kevin James, you might remember. Please welcome Sophie!
And for Sophie Evans, it's her name on the marquee for about half of her bookings these days. She's the main attraction at the castle's close-up gallery, a small Victorian parlor where the crowd is near enough to get properly wowed by her masterful sleight of hand.
Thank you. Want to see it go backwards?
Oh, yes.
Very cool. I like you people.
She says she's learned magic performance from the best seat in the house, one that male magicians never get to sit in.
Magic was created by men. So when you buy a magic book, they talk about your inside left breast pocket, trouser pocket, front pocket, waistcoat pocket. Well, I don't know how many women have any of those. So it's not easy to take it and adapt it for us, which I think makes us more creative.
For instance, if you see her close-up act and you're wondering where your eight of clubs went, here's a hint. You might want to check the bottom of her stiletto heel. In Hollywood, I'm Nate DeMeo for Weekend America.
You're listening to Week in America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. My daughter is saying goodbye to high school next week. And going through her senior year with her, it's taken me so back to those days where high school meant everything. There's drama around the locker. There's drama around text messages. There's drama like, do I have the right hairstyle? What if I forget the lines in the school play? You know, and then what about that C in physics? Is that going to keep you out of your top choice colleges? So if you've ever been through that, which you have if you've been through high school, you're not alone. We went to a website. It's called Where Have All the Prom Queens Gone? And readers there posted their memories of high school. So we've compiled a few of their letters to help us look back on those tormented days in high school. And in between, you might recognize some movie clips from the master of teen angst, filmmaker John Hughes.
My God, are we going to be like our parents?
Not me. Ever. It's unavoidable. Just happens.
What happens?
When you grow up, your heart dies.
My high school experience started out quite normally, I suppose. Coming out of eighth grade, some of my friends were the popular kids. Some were the band people, like me. And others were just regular kids. But when I got to high school, everything changed. The kids that I considered my friends from my early years had now become part of the crowd of kids that were the jocks, the student council members, and the beauty queens. But I was no beauty queen. I had a severely recessed chin and big, round, green eyes. This was how people in my family looked, and they seemingly accepted me just fine. But I became known to those kids I'd never met as a fish. I withdrew. I contemplated suicide. And my parents, rest their souls, had no clue. Not because they didn't want to know, but because I refused to bring them into my tortured world. I would take stairs between classes that I knew they wouldn't take. I would come to school through different doors, and I began to limit my interactions to those kids who were more like me. Ostracized. Band members, geeks, unattractive kids. Kids with good hearts. So I hunkered down with my newfound friends who thought I was fun, funny, smart, and had a clue as to what was really important. In my last year of high school, I really had a great time. Alice, class of 1980.
Okay, you're right. He's not like the others. If you don't go to him now, I'm never going to take you to another prom ever again, you hear me? I mean, this is an incredibly romantic moment, and you're ruining it for me.
Stucky.
Go ahead.
I was the quarterback. I dated the captain of the cheerleading squad my entire senior year. She was jealous of the prom queen, who was a fellow cheerleader. I liked the prom queen, too. It's funny to think back on some of those dirty looks in the hallway between the girls. Jamie, class of 1976.
Why do birds suddenly appear?
She just seemed to know she was getting the tiara, didn't she? That, oh my God, expression and teary-eyed reaction was all a put-on. That slow-motion walk to stand up near the quarterback? Ugh, she had some nerve. I should have been the queen. I'm the one who decorated the gym and made cookies for the pep club. I was the student council president and the girl that was nice to everyone. And I had to stand there and watch her walk the walk and take the prize. Excruciating. Amy, class of 1975.
Yep. I said it before and I'll say it again. Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Going to my 20-year class reunion was important to me. Mainly because I'm a successful lawyer.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't wait to throw it in their faces, to confront those kids that had made fun of me. But when I got there, those kids didn't even remember my name. That means I've suffered all these years and they had no recollection. How could they not remember? How could they be so impervious to the pain they caused? Well, they didn't. And that taught me the most important lesson. Kids are kids. Ken, class of 1982.
If you have a story of high school woe, get over it. Just give the story to us. Come to our website at weekendamerica.org.
My prom angst was that I couldn't make out with my date.
What?
This was, all the teenagers around us sucking face to Journey's Open Arms just seemed like such a bad imitation of a child's idea of grown-up love. And I just felt like, we are kids. What are you doing? I couldn't mash on my date. It just looked too silly.
That's so mature of you. I know the moms loved you. I was a transplant in high school, so that was hard enough coming into high school, the new girl. But then my arch nemesis, Linda, made it even harder. She laughed at my clothes. She made sure I wasn't invited to parties. She stole my boyfriend, or at least the guy that I wished was my boyfriend. So I never went back to, I didn't go back to my reunion. Did you? Did you go back to your high school
reunion? I went back to kiss my prom date. But, that didn't happen, sadly. No.
Well, you never live high school down. You're listening to Weekend America.
At Decatur High School in Federal Way, Washington, Verna is still waiting for a kiss where it's partly cloudy and 65 today. Here's more weekend weather with Brendan Noonan.
Dayton, Ohio is hosting the first annual CultureWorks Cornhole Tournament of the Arts this weekend. As we all know, cornhole is another name for a beanbag toss. It costs $25 to enter the tournament. Winners get a grand, and all proceeds go to funding the arts in the greater Dayton region. It's going to be partly cloudy with a high of 80 degrees. Good weather for cornhole. In Springerville, Arizona this weekend, motorcyclists will be getting their kicks along Route 666, a.k.a. the Devil's Highway. The 265-mile route is the curviest road in the country. The forecast calls for what I'm guessing is a cold day in hell, sunshine and a high of 80 degrees. Who knew that the road to perdition is actually a highway? The annual Kona Underwater Classic is being held this weekend. It's an underwater photo and video competition held on the Big Island of Hawaii. Since they're going to be wet already, attendees shouldn't be too bothered by the scattered showers. Among the moving pictures you won't find at the Classic, Silence of the Clams, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Squid, and a streetcar named Calamari. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Brendan Noonan for Weekend America.
In Brighton Beach, New York, life looks westward, but the music drifts in from the east. Meet a melancholy diva next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness, online at loveandforgive.org. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This evening, Primorsky Restaurant in Brighton Beach, New York, is serving eel salad and a gefilte fish appetizer and Russian crepes with caviar, red or black. And then from 9 until 3 a.m., it's time for music. Brighton Beach is also called Little Odessa. Its emigres have found community and refuge from the hardships of home and a longing that's still with them. Reporter Daniela Gerson got to know one of the neighborhood's musical fixtures.
The singer Victoria Lezina sits alone at Primorsky's restaurant in Brighton Beach. As Saturday afternoon turns into evening, diners chat in Russian and feast on platters of meat dumplings and pickled veggies. This Brooklyn enclave is home to immigrants from across the former Soviet Union. And Victoria knows songs to please them all. Victoria looks like the diva she is. She wears stretch pants that cling to her rather voluptuous body, a red velour top, and a homemade fox fur and Velcro headband. The 52-year-old closes her eyes and sings a sweet ode to Leningrad and childhood friends from the Communist Youth Group. Victoria sings pure nostalgia, her own memories of growing up in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city, are more complicated. On the one hand, she was a successful musician, conducting a popular classical and jazz orchestra that performed in movie theaters.
In movie theater, before the movie, they have a special stage, and the real people play real instruments. In 8 years, I was in my city like in a paradise, because it was very big happiness to be inside your circle of people. And I was in my place over there.
But she could never feel completely secure. Victoria is Jewish, and in the 1980s, anti-Semitism in Ukraine was widespread. Her son was beaten up in school for being Jewish. Members of her own orchestra refused to play for a group of visiting Israeli dignitaries.
Question, because it's a little bit dangerous for us. Because in Ukraine, in Soviet Union, in Russia, all the time we have danger from the beginning of the state, because all the time we felt we are not a citizen of that country. We are all the time strangers.
When the Soviet Empire began to crumble, Victoria and her family finally had the chance to leave. And she dreamed of making music in the land of her favorite singer, Ella Fitzgerald. Victoria hoped to sell her compositions to Broadway musicians, but she quickly found that none of her accomplishments in Kharkiv were worth much on 42nd Street.
And I realized that I have to be in a different situation. I have to change the profession, maybe, to survive. And I was crying half a year.
So Victoria made her way to Brighton Beach and found she could survive by singing in neighborhood restaurants and nightclubs.
Because this is a special country, different country inside the country, Russian country. Brighton Beach in a Russian country.
But it's Russia circa 1985. DJs in Moscow and Kiev spin the latest hip-hop and techno. But in Brighton Beach, Soviet-era standards are still the rage. The nostalgic mix includes Russian pop, city anthems, and love songs.
So do you know one from Armenia?
Of course I know.
Sing in Armenian.
Oy, sirun, sirun, ta-la-di-da-da, la-la-di-da-da.
But there's one key difference from the old country. Melodies that were dangerous for Soviet Jews to listen to are now favorite crowd pleasers. That song is on Victoria's latest self-produced CD, International Program. But after nearly two decades in America, Victoria is losing faith that her name will ever be known beyond these few blocks where Brooklyn meets the ocean.
Our profession is not for this place. And our music is some sort of soul subject. It's not material stuff. We can only imagine, to hear, and to feel. This country for to sell, for to buy.
And Victoria is tired of the late nights entertaining drunk Russian men who don't appreciate her compositions. She's decided she will sing the music she wants or not at all. So now there's a new singer at Primorsky's on Saturday evenings. Before the disco ball begins to flash, Victoria wraps herself in her fur jacket and declares herself done for the day. In Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, I'm Daniela Gerson for Weekend America.
Город над вольной Невой, город нашей славы.
Victoria Lesina is singing a song about a man's memories of protecting Leningrad during World War II, and now it's been reinvented in St. Petersburg as a popular soccer cheer.
Oh, it sounds so beautiful to be part of a sports chant. But we'd like to hear your stories of musical inspiration for a segment that we call Weekend Soundtrack. When the weekend comes and the time is your own, how do you weave it with music?
We have met people who bring back their homeland with a song, people who use music to get fired up on the weekend. What's your weekend soundtrack and the story behind it? Let us know at weekendamerica.org. That's another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America, produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, who's transforming her kitchen away from Robin's Egg Blue circa 1965. Millie Jefferson, Ia Kobe, Philip Stearns, Sam Keenan. This weekend he's going to a hipster joint with his younger sister for her birthday. Michael Rayfield, Tim Bomba. Angela Kim is in New York this weekend accepting her Gracie Award.
Also Rob Beyer, Susie Lechtenberg, Chrissy Clark. Jim Gates will be checking out the Grand Old Day Street Fair in St. Paul this weekend. Convenient since he lives on Grand. Brendan Noonan, Michael May, David Banks, Phyllis Owens, John Moe, who's patiently awaiting the release of Kung Fu Panda next weekend, and Mark Sanchez.
Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney, getting his son his first two-wheeled bike. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of it at weekendamerica.org. This weekend, I'm joining a man as he indulges his weekend hobby of excavating old plane crashes, and I'll bring you that story on a future program. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Congratulations, Ray, my daughter, for your graduation. Remember, have a great weekend.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul. And made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Picture this. It's Friday night or Saturday afternoon. You're home. No, wait. You're driving in your car. What song are you listening to?
It's really spastic, but it also has undertones of something a little bit more serious.
I'm Bill Radke, the host of Weekend America. Join us each week as we capture the sound of your weekend.